Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will happen in the next 10 years of world history? And what will the United States need to do to respond effectively to imminent changes? George Friedman is president and CEO of the Austin-based geopolitical intelligence firm Stratfor. The last time he was here, we talked about his predictions for the entire century stretching before us. His latest book offers detailed predictions about some surprising events that may affect us in the near future, including a nascent alliance between Russia and Germany, a treaty, though not a friendship, between the U.S. and Iran, and a growing American role in the development of Pakistan. The book is called The Next Decade, Where We've Been and Where We're Going. George, welcome back to Think.
Thank you for having me again.
I want to start with this. Is it an entirely different process to look at the next 10 years as opposed to looking at an entire century?
In a way, yes. When you're looking at a whole century, particular events really don't matter all that much. So, for example, the Boer War in the early part of the 20th century was a huge issue at the time. Didn't matter in the long run. What you're looking for is impersonal forces that are going to sustain itself for a century. When you write about a decade, people become important. Decisions become more important. It's not that you can decide to do whatever you want. You're still severely constrained by the realities you work in. But those decisions, those policies that are made matter a lot more. And who the leaders are, who the president of the United States is, matters a lot more. So, you know, going back in 100 years and looking at the century, I don't much care what Calvin Coolidge might have had to say. But while I was alive in the 1920s, it probably mattered a great deal.
Should the world have seen what happened in Egypt coming?
Well, I'm not sure what happened in Egypt. We had demonstrations, about 300,000 people, very small demonstrations for a city the size of Cairo. Mm-hmm. Nothing like the kind of demonstrations we saw in 1979 in Iran or the 1989 uprisings in Eastern Europe. What happened was that we had a military leader, Hosni Mubarak. He's out of office. We have a new group of military leaders. They have suspended the Constitution and Parliament and have promised something in the future elections. So from where I sit, extraordinarily little has happened in Egypt, and the world's media just went absolutely berserk like it was the second coming. It's an amazing distinction, because when you step back and say, so what's changed? Nothing, except that there is far less freedom in Egypt now than there was before. Interesting.
So you don't see this necessarily as the start of a massive shift toward democracy that would sort of mirror what happened in the former Soviet Union in the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, if there was a massive shift to democracy, we'd probably wind up with an Islamic Republic.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is a democracy.
Right.
So the first thing is this notion that if you become a democracy, you're going to vote to become like Wisconsin. It's kind of crazy. Secondly, there may be a democracy, I don't know, but nothing that's happened so far indicates that, aside from what's been said, that that's what's going to happen. And I just want to emphasize, this was not a massive uprising of the Egyptian people. To a very great extent, the demonstrators could all be contained in one square in Cairo, one of the largest cities in the world. You didn't have a general strike. You didn't have people of all walks of life gathering. This was by and large the young. And for all of the, you know, blathering hysteria about how important the young had become, you know, I'm a baby boomer. I remember when we were going to change the world.
So what made those demonstrations powerful enough to convince Mubarak to step aside after all those years?
Everybody has been wanting Mubarak to step aside, particularly the military.
Mm-hmm.
The military realized something because they're very subtle. He's 82 years old. He's going to die. They wanted to have an orderly succession. Mubarak said that he wanted himself to be succeeded by his son, Gamal. The military was absolutely furious about this. Gamal was not one of them. He had not served in the military. He was well known for his corruption, his arrogance, and he's only 47 years old. So the military wanted him out, and Mubarak resisted them. The demonstrations were extremely convenient to the military because it got the military exactly what he wanted. In other words, the military wanted Mubarak to resign. They wanted senior military officials to essentially form a junta. And they obviously wanted this to appear to be a democratic rising. So you got a democratic rising that created a military junta. And that's exactly what was wanted. This, you know, the public may have wanted Mubarak out. I don't know. The demonstrators certainly wanted Mubarak out. The military wanted Mubarak out. But what's interesting about the demonstrators, they never demanded regime change. They never opposed the military. And I'm just fascinated by the way in which the crowd delivered for the senior military leaders exactly what they wanted.
Any way to predict at this stage what might come of the Egypt-Israeli peace treaty?
Well, the Egypt-Israeli peace treaty is something that is in the interest of both parties. The Egyptians fought four wars before 1973, were defeated in all of them. They have no desire to get bogged down one more time in another war with Egypt. And the very first thing that the new government said was that the peace treaty will remain intact. But even if it doesn't, even if they abrogate it, there's nothing the Egyptians can do, because their army consists entirely of American weapons. That means that U.S. spare parts and American contractors keep their army going, pull those out, and they don't have an army. So I'm not really concerned about an imminent war. 10, 15, 20 years down the road, that's another question, not for this decade.
You argue in this book that over the next decade, the best move for the U.S. will be to back off from its largely unqualified support of Israel.
Well, I mean, we have. I mean, the United States is totally committed to the survival of Israel. Israel's survival is not at stake and hasn't been since the treaty with Egypt. Israel will survive. Even the Israelis are now saying that there's no imminent threat of an Iranian nuclear strike. The Israelis have backed off from their relationship with the United States by proceeding with settlements and such things that the United States have asked them not to do. And they've said they're doing so because national sovereignty dictates that they should have that right, which it does. The aid the United States gave to Israel in 1973 was 25% of Israel's GDP. Today, it's less than 1.5%. So, yeah, the relationship has changed in fundamental ways. Both sides are less dependent on each other. The Israelis, in particular, have been very assertive that they do not have to get permission from the United States to proceed with their foreign policy. It follows from that that the United States doesn't need to get permission from the Israelis. Intelligence sharing will continue. The fundamental guarantee will continue. But it's not so much that I'm saying we should back off from that relationship. I'm saying that relationship has changed dramatically, so that talking about it in terms of the apocalyptic terms that existed before 1973 just makes no sense.
You also think that the U.S. and Iran could ultimately need to sign a treaty despite serious ongoing conflicts. Can you talk about what such an agreement would stipulate?
Well, let's begin with the basic fact and forget nuclear weapons. Iran is the most powerful conventional military force in the Persian Gulf. It is by far more powerful than any combination of forces against them. If the United States withdraws from Iraq, which we are committed to, there will be no force strong enough to block Iran. That means that Iraq is going to fall into the Iranian sphere of influence. It also means that Iraq will be in a position to influence events in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, up to and including potentially military strikes. The United States can't remain in Iraq with 50,000 troops, because that's not enough to do anything but take casualties. If we leave, we hand Iraq to the Iranians. We do have the option of a massive conventional war, basically based on airstrikes to destroy the Iranian Navy, Air Force, and Army. But the problem is that the Iranians respond by blocking the Straits of Hormuz. About 25% of the world's export oil will be cut off, in which case the global economic recovery will absolutely crash through the ground.
So that's not an option, is what you're saying.
So the only option we have then is to withdraw and let the Iranians do what they want, try to use their fear of the United States, which is substantial, to shape some sort of agreement that gives them a great deal of what they want, but not everything, particularly not Saudi Arabia. The two choices are, at this point, let them have it on their own, go to war, or cut a deal. It's not that I want a deal, but those are the cards that have been dealt, and we're going to have to make a decision about one of those.
Do you think there would be a lot of resistance domestically from people who say, regardless of what this might guarantee for us, it's a slippery slope, and it will mean that a couple years down the line, we're going to have to give Iran more than we wanted to?
Sure. I mean, that they'll be absolutely right. And then I'll turn around and ask them, so what's your move? The problem here is that it's very easy to object to every one of these moves. It's easy to object to the war because it might fail and we might leave Iran in a more powerful position. It's easy to object to leaving troops in Iraq. It's easy to object to a deal. The problem is the president doesn't have the option of not doing something because not doing something is doing something. And his problem now is one of leadership, which is that he doesn't have any good choices like George W. Bush before him. He's going to be picking from a lot of bad choices, and whatever he does can't be predicted what's going to happen, and it could turn out that the entire thing destroys his presidency. That's what presidents are made for.
I mean, one could argue that, you know, what's done is done, but were there any circumstances under which we could have invaded Iraq without the consequence of empowering Iran?
I think so. But it would have been a much more massive invasion. And U.S. intelligence and the Bush administration misread the situation in Iraq. It was believed that once we conquered Iraq, the Iraqi population would be essentially passive. They missed the fact that the Iranian intelligence services had organized the Shiite community very effectively and that this was going to happen. So there was a huge intelligence failure, far bigger than the weapons of mass destruction failure, was the failure to understand what was going to happen after we conquered it. You could argue that we should not have invaded Iraq. There are certain arguments for it or against it, but clearly our ultimate goal, which was to establish a powerful pro-American government in Iraq, failed, opening the door to the Iranians.
How great a threat is a nuclear-powered Iran?
I think a conventional-powered Iran is a much greater threat.
Why is that?
Well, because they have it right now, and they don't have nuclear weapons for a while. And one nuclear weapon doesn't do you a whole lot of good unless you're planning to commit suicide, and the Iranians are not suicidal. The fact of the matter is that Iran is, without nuclear weapons, the major regional power. It's right now the major regional power. And as soon as the United States withdraws its troops, which we're committed to, nothing can stand in the way of the Iranian military. And that's the basic problem that we have. Now, one of our problems is that by focusing on the nuclear issue, we've really missed the realities on the ground of existing power. And we tend to fixate on nuclear weapons and forget other things.
George Friedman is my guest. He's president and CEO of the geopolitical intelligence firm Stratfor. His new book is called The Next Decade, Where We've Been and Where We're Going. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is George Friedman. He is president and CEO of the Austin-based geopolitical intelligence firm Stratfor. His new book is called The Next Decade, Where We've Been and Where We're Going. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. You are adamant here, George, that whether we like it or not, the U.S. is a de facto empire. What makes that so?
We constitute 25%, a little less, of the global economy, which means that just about every decision we make affects someone, for good or bad, in the world. We control all of the oceans of the world, the U.S. Navy does. We talk about globalization. Globalization means increased international trade. That trade takes place on the oceans. The United States is in a position, if it wishes, and it doesn't right now, to block that trade or block the trade of any particular nation. We have troops in 27 countries in the world, and that's down. We have been cutting back. We look like an empire. We behave like an empire in the sense that if something happens in Egypt, if something happens in Central Asia, we are involved. I mean, when you think about it, why is the President of the United States giving advice to crowds demonstrating in Egypt against its government? Because it is a global power, and because what happens in Egypt affects U.S. interests, and there's nothing in the world that doesn't affect U.S. interests. And we're the only country in the world with that global capability.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Remember, you can also email think@kera.org. We have Salam on the line in Dallas. Hi, Salam.
Hi. Yes, I do have a comment for your guest. I'm surprised and perplexed at how he's completely dismissing or downplaying the grassroots movement of the pro-democracy Egyptian people to topple the government. He's making it sound as if this is somehow minority-driven and does not reflect the majority of Egyptians, or that somehow this is staged by the military. He's completely wrong, with all due respect. And I can tell you that this kind of thinking has led to a very flawed, severely flawed U.S. foreign policy in the region, because these self-proclaimed experts of the Middle East, you know, had it wrong for the past 40 years and keep on missing the point. And I'll take my comments over the air.
Thanks for your call. George, you want to respond to that?
Well, that's a reasonable point. I'm a very simple man. 350,000 people can't claim to speak for all of Egypt. The Egyptian peasants haven't spoken. The Egyptian shopkeepers haven't spoken. I think it's enormously presumptuous for the demonstrators to claim that they speak for the Egyptian people. In particular, I think it's very presumptuous to think, not that they don't want democracy, they may well, but that we know what kind of government is going to emerge. There have been no elections held. And I think one of the things that happens in all this enthusiasm is that people tend to read their own views into what the demonstrators want. So, yes, the demonstrators were very small relative to Egypt. It's 80 million people, and very few people demonstrated. Yes, they were protected by the military, which is interesting because the military drove the police out. But unless we want to say that not only do they speak for the entire country, but we know how they're going to vote, then we don't know what kind of government they're going to create. And, of course, the essence of democracy is the type of government that you want. And I think one of the reasons that enthusiasts for democracy continually get the situation wrong around the world is they quickly forget that the election isn't the key. It's who's elected. And we don't know who the Egyptian public will elect until there is elections. And we just don't know if there are going to be elections because it's now in the hands of the military. And because when I look at the situation, I see the military acting with confidence and certainty as to what they're going to do. So I don't know what's going to happen in 6 to 9 months. And I think one of the problems is we've made a lot of assumptions about what happened in Egypt. And it reminds me of the assumptions that were made in 1979 in Iran, where certainly there were far more people in the streets. We assumed that what was going on was a democratic rising, and it was a democratic rising, but the people wanted an Islamist government. So there are a million things we don't know, but this much we do know. We know that of the 80 million people in Egypt, very few turned out to demonstrate. We know the army supported their demonstrations. We know that the army suspended the constitution and the parliament after the election. And we know that the army has said that they were going to have new elections in a few months. Well, we don't know if they will. And so this is a game unfolding, and I'm somewhat taken aback by people, the caller included, assuming that this is over, or even that it played out the way they thought it would. This was a very odd thing that happened in Egypt.
So you think,
and we'll see what happens.
If the Egyptian army had not found that it suited its purposes to support those demonstrators, they could have it could have easily put down all of the demonstrations taking place in Alexandria and in Cairo and elsewhere?
Yes, but even more importantly, the Egyptian army was making sure the demonstrators could get in to demonstrate.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the ones who forced the police who were hostile to demonstrators out. And from the very beginning, they were the ones who were supporting the demonstration. Now, when you bear in mind that the people who were making these decisions were Mubarak's closest associates, people of that generation, and not people who in the past 30 years have spoken out for democracy, you have to inquire as to what their motives were. When we had demonstrations in 1979 in Iran or 1989 Eastern Europe, millions of people gathered in the streets. Millions of people, large percentages of the population. What is most striking to me in this is that you didn't have those millions pouring out. You had a very small number of people, very friendly to the military. The military very friendly to them. Now we'll see what happens.
What happens in China as its economic growth must absolutely, almost as a matter of course, slow down? Certainly it won't stop, but what happens there?
Well, the problem that China has is, and I'll use some Chinese government statistics, there are 1.3 billion Chinese. 600 million live in households earning between $1 and $3 a day, less than $3 a day. That's extraordinarily poor.
Mm-hmm.
440 million earn between $3 and $6 a day. So of the 1.3 billion Chinese, over 1 billion live in what I'll call sub-Saharan poverty. They're extraordinarily poor. There's the China that we think about when we think about modern developing China. There are about 60 million people, mostly concentrated in the coastal region, whose families earn over $20,000 a year, the middle class, the ones who buy the goods that the Chinese factories produce. That's a lot of people. That's the size of France. But it's less than 5% of China. So when I think of China, I think of a vast, very poor country with a very small industrial base that primarily sells to foreign countries because they can't sell inside of China. When you're earning $3 a day, you're not buying iPads. And this China is come under tremendous economic pressure. Labor costs have risen because, in fact, although there are over a billion Chinese, most are not suited to work in the advanced factories that are being built. So that today, Mexico has a lower labor cost than China. The time that China was the low labor cost place is gone. And China is hostage to the consumption of Europe and the United States. This means they have to restructure their economy. Some of the factories that were producing what used to be low-cost goods have to be closed. The Chinese don't want unemployment. They're terrified of unemployment. And so they are subsidizing these factories with loans, which is why loans are surging. And, of course, the economy under these circumstances grows, but it's not a healthy growth because there's no profit. I can grow any business if I sell at or below cost. The trick is to grow your economy when you're making a profit, which they did for 30 years. So they have this tension between the real China of over a billion people, the Western China of about 60 million people, and a couple of hundred million who have illegally migrated to the cities to work in the factories and who might be the unemployed and the unstable element. And so the Chinese are cracking down everywhere. There's tremendous repression from the internet to the streets. And people say, you know, China's doing so marvelously, why are they cracking down? Either the Chinese are stupid or they know something. We don't, and I think they're not stupid at all. They're very worried about their situation. I suspect that China, I'm sure China will survive, but like Japan in 1990, when we were all saying that the Japanese superstate was going to dominate the United States in just 10 years, the Chinese are running into the wall that all economies eventually run into, and it's hurting a lot.
We knew this was coming for some time, but this week it became official that, in fact, China superseded Japan as the world's second largest economy. Is that anything that, Japan should be worrying about?
No, because Japan has one reality that China doesn't. It doesn't have a billion people on the edge of starvation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge difference. That's a tremendous advantage for Japan. So China can produce more, but they can only sell it overseas. The Japanese can actually consume what they produce. I put it this way. The Chinese have 60 million people living in what we'll call first world middle class life. The Chinese have over 100 million in that same position. So when you look at those figures, instead of the number of widgets they produce, Japan is a much more healthy country.
You have some interesting thoughts here about how the United States' relationship with Pakistan and India will change relative to each other. Can you talk about that?
Well, to remember, during the Cold War, the United States and India had very hostile relations. India was an ally of the Soviet Union. The United States was an ally of Pakistan. After 9/11, the United States grew closer to India in order to put pressure on Pakistan. In Afghanistan, the United States can only even imagine winning the war if the Pakistanis are prepared to allow them to go into Pakistan, if the Pakistanis agree to fight Taliban and other forces on Pakistani soil, essentially if the Pakistanis agree to a civil war. Well, they're not going to agree to that. They can't agree to that. They'll agree to it and not do it. I mean, the United States is asking for the impossible for the Pakistanis. In the meantime, the United States can't win the war with 150,000 troops. I don't even know what winning the war in Afghanistan means. Therefore, the United States in 1 year, 5 years, is leaving. Taliban knows that. Pakistan knows that. When the United States leaves, the United States is going to be very dependent on Pakistan to keep order in Afghanistan, but the Pakistanis have a national interest in doing so because Afghanistan is their western frontier. It's in our interest to make certain that Pakistan does not collapse into chaos, and also that it counterbalances India. American strategy is the balance of power, and we want to make certain that Pakistan and India maintain the balance of power they did since 1948. You know, people have said we're friends with India. Countries aren't friends. It's a kind of insane idea. Can you imagine Microsoft and Google doing a business deal because they're friends? I mean, we would never say that about a company.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we imagine friendship having an element in international relations? I mean, sentiment doesn't play a part of it. In the end, we want India strong, but not too strong. The only country that can balance is Pakistan. China can't because it's behind the Himalayas. It just doesn't play in that. So for a lot of reasons, oddly enough, we have an interest in maintaining Pakistan as strong a power. And one of the problems with President Obama's strategy in Afghanistan is that it undermines the Pakistanis in a war that we're not going to win, we're going to withdraw from. And we'll want Pakistan as strong as possible to handle the situation.
What would the world have to worry about if India gained greater control over the Indian Ocean?
Well, the Indian Ocean is the line of supply that the world's oil from the Persian Gulf flows through. We would now be dependent on decisions made in India as to whether that flow would continue, rather than the decisions made in Washington. There is no advantage to the United States of giving India this power. There is a potential disadvantage of giving it this power. since the fundamental principle of the United States ought to be retaining control of the seas, and we can do so relatively easily, why take that sort of risk? What is the advantage? It's far better that India remain a land power concerned with Pakistan, and that the United States retain control of the Indian Ocean.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Bill on the line in Dallas. Hello, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I wanted to come back to the previous decade instead of the next decade, although I'm enjoying the next decade. Mr. Friedman said that the invasion of Iraq was a failure of the administration and the intelligence community to recognize what was going to happen and therefore shift the balance of power. I heard a senior officer from the CIA who had retired who said the CIA was very clear that that could happen and therefore it was a bad idea. So I just wanted to clarify or ask for his clarification if he believes that's true. I mean, this person said that the administration had in fact not listened to the intelligence briefing from the intelligence community. The CIA was very clear what would happen. It was just not a good idea what was taking place, and there were ideological reasons that caused it to happen.
George, what do you know about that?
Well, the CIA is 40 million people, 40,000 people. Somebody says everything. At the time, and I had some contact with people there, there was not a major concern over an extended guerrilla war. During that time, there were some people who were warning about it. I have to say I wasn't in the agency, but I was. There was some warning. It was not the main thrust of what the agency said. I have to be a little cynical here, having some knowledge. There are many times in which the agency makes fundamental mistakes and then falls back on minority views to show what they transmitted. It's understandable, it's clear. But the idea that the agency was warning that Saddam Hussein's Special Republican Guard was building a guerrilla capability after the war, maybe, but I didn't hear it.
George Friedman is here. We are talking about his new book, The Next Decade, Where We've Been and Where We're Going. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is President and CEO of the geopolitical intelligence firm Stratfor. His new book is called The Next Decade, Where We've Been and Where We're Going. George Friedman is his name. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. To be clear, what is the difference between what you do, your writing, your thought processes, and a historian? Because I hear a distinction being made. What is the difference between, you're not exactly H.G. Wells, you're not really a futurist, but you're not really a historian either. And I was wondering if you could sort of describe where you see yourself compared to sort of those people. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I see myself as an intelligence analyst. I work in intelligence in understanding what has happened in the past and creating models to predict the future. When I wrote the next 100 years or the next decade, obviously I was doing something a historian doesn't do. I was making forecasts, but I try to embed what I do deeply in history in this sense. Bad analogy, but the best I can come up with, we're watching a movie. We're living a small piece in it. We're wondering what's going to come next. We have to look to the past to find what brought us to this point and then extrapolate based on that to what likely is going to happen in the future to understand the constraints that are limiting us, the forces that are pushing us. So I don't think the choice is, as an intelligence analyst, is between being a futurist and being a historian. you have to be both, and you have to move back and forth between the two. I know that's not a really clear answer, but a really clear answer would take a very long time. But it's, I'm trying to kind of give you the essence of what I do. To look at the future, you've got to have an intimate understanding of the past.
Let me follow up on Ken's question with this. No analyst, no matter how brilliant, can get everything right. In fact, it would be rather scary if that were to happen. Obviously, when you go through and you sort of check off the things that happened close to what you imagined would happen, you can learn something from how you predicted those. What do you learn from the places where you guessed wrong?
Well, I mean, a really interesting place is I never thought the euro would form. I thought the euro couldn't get off the ground. And what I really didn't understand, and it taught me something, was the extent to which politics can overwhelm economic rationality. And I came away from that with a much deeper respect for the political forces compared to the economic ones.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the phones, we go to Ulysses, and we'll speak with Peter. Hi, Peter.
I have a question for Dr. Friedman. I've actually read your book, The Next 100 Years. I haven't had time to read The Next Decade. But my question relates to Africa. You know, I've heard China is making some aggressive economic push in Africa, making a lot of resource deals, you know, concessions from African governments and actually posturing itself, you know, for future economic gains. What is the United States doing to counter China's aggressive push? And secondly, moving into the next decade, my question relates to space. You know, the growing, well, the need to financialize or militarize space. What does the future look in that regard?
Thanks so much for your call, Peter.
Well, the Chinese are buying a great many assets in Africa. I think many of them will never turn out to be profitable, and they're going to be substantial losses to the Chinese because the infrastructure cost of getting the materials out outweigh the value. One of the things that the Chinese are doing is what the Japanese did in the 1990s when they bought Rockefeller Center and Pebble Beach. There's a lot of money rushing out of China because they don't want to invest in China. And so they're buying mines and everything, and they're not always very economical. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the next decade is Africa, a continent which ought to be spectacularly successful and isn't. And its underlying problem is that its political map and its social map don't match.
Still dealing with the colonial borders that existed. Is that?
Yes, that's what I mean. I mean, the borders that have been drawn cut through what we call tribes, which are nations, and that put together hostile nations into one state, and this creates inherent chaos. We're not going to have Africa clearing itself up until it has some very massive internal wars, and an imperial power emerges in Africa. I think it should be South Africa, but it's not behaving that way. That creates some order. You can't have economic development in a country that's in a state of civil war, and virtually every country in Africa has so much internal tension, it's almost impossible to get anything done. On the question of space, I don't think the next decade is going to be a major time in space, but I am convinced that in the next century, space is going to be the foundation not only of military power, out of economic power. One of our biggest needs is energy. The price, we're going to need more energy, not less energy. We can't continue to live on fossil fuels because they're on the whole too expensive. We have to drop the price of energy dramatically to take care of a range of problems we have. And so I believe in solar power, but I don't think solar power works on the face of the Earth. I think it has to be based in space. And there are many companies, including American companies, NASA and others, who are working very hard on space-based solar energy. And I think that project is what we ought to look at.
Going back to the question of the African continent, and we understand here that there are multiple nations which are in sort of various states of either order or chaos, but you don't see, beyond the provision of a reasonable amount of humanitarian aid, that it would make much sense for the U.S. to try to intervene in African conflicts right now?
Well, there have been many interventions. There have been many aid projects. They don't address the fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem is one that only the Africans can address to themselves, the rationalization of their political borders. You can't impose order. You can impose disorder. The Europeans did a fine job of creating chaos in Africa for their own ends. Then they left. The United States now faces an issue where the only thing you can cause in Africa is more disorder. It is simply a continent best left to its own, because then there's the possibility that the tensions that are built up will ultimately resolve the problem.
We have an email here from Joe who writes, "For some reason, it appears your guest today is totally pessimistic. There has to be reason for hope. Otherwise, we ought to all go out and hide in a cave somewhere and just give up." We should say that there is a lot, particularly for the United States, that is quite optimistic in this book.
I am enormously optimistic for the United States and for the world. My job as an intelligence guy is to point out the trouble. I mean, you know, optimism is easy. Doing the hard work getting to the good place is very, very hard, and very frequently you're going to look like you're going backwards. The example I love to give is that we wound up with the British Empire, and it was a triumph, and everybody forgets that it fought a seven-year insurgency in North America and got its behind kicked by the Americans, and everybody said that the best days of England were over. Well, obviously they weren't. But if I had been the British, and if I had been living in the time of the Revolution, I wouldn't be spending my time dreaming about what will come. I'd be busy trying to devise a counterinsurgency strategy or a withdrawal strategy.
Talk about this for a minute. We teased this in the beginning of the show. Right now, everyone is so concerned about unemployment, but you think by the end of the decade, we will actually have concerns about labor shortages?
Well, birth rates are dropping everywhere in the world. In every group, women are having fewer children. This is true in Bangladesh and the Islamic world. In the advanced industrial world in Europe, it has now fallen below the rate of replacement, which is 2.1 births per woman, which means that by the end of by next 20, 30 years, a country like Germany is going to lose a quarter of its population. Under those circumstances, with both an aging population and a declining workforce, we have a serious crisis, not of unemployment, but of finding enough workers. We're going to be looking at technologies. We're looking at immigrants coming in. We're going to be desperately looking for more people. In fact, the United States is the only advanced industrial country that doesn't have this problem. Not because the native birth rate isn't below 2.1. It's way below 2.1. It's because we have a lot of immigrants who have a lot of children. Now, that may change the ethnic makeup of the United States down the road. It will. But it's one of the reasons why we are not facing the kind of crises that Japan and Germany is.
Are there particular industries that will be especially hard hit by labor shortages?
Well, the one that worries me the most, of course, is healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Because before we get to a smaller population, we're going to have a huge bulge in old people, the baby boomers particularly. They are living longer, but the last 10, 20 years in their lives are frequently lived in a debilitated state where they become massive consumers of all sorts of services because they can't take care of themselves. So that's a place, those nursing homes that we all know of and many of us will wind up in, need workers. And those workers range from very sophisticated physicians and various technicians to unskilled or semi-skilled labor, and that's the place where we're going to feel it the most. Where are we going to get the people to take care of our population that is living longer but not better?
I've waited until late into the hour to get into something that is, I think, very interesting. One thing that you predict is that Russia and Germany over the next few years could forge a much stronger alliance than they've had in the recent past. What's happening right now that seems to point to that?
Well, the Germans, of course, have faced this enormous crisis in the EU, where they discovered that they are going to be called upon to bail out a bunch of economies. Their idea of the EU was this was a wonderful place for them to be prosperous. They didn't count on the kind of crisis we had.
Mm-hmm.
The Russians, in the meantime, have created a massive flow of natural gas to Germany, which Germany is entirely dependent on. It can't live without Russian natural gas. The Russians, in the meantime, want technology, which the Germans have. The Germans have a declining population, but they don't want any more immigrants. They have a Muslim problem that frightens them. They don't want any more Muslims coming in. Since they can't get immigrants, they're going to have to export their factories to where the workers are. Russia's having a declining population, but interestingly, in spite of that, they still have more people than underemployed, if you will. And so you have a synergy between Russia and Germany, and add one thing to it. Neither of them particularly likes the balance of power in the world. They think the United States has too much power. The United States is leaning on them too heavily. This is not something they want, so they have a lot of political, a lot of economic interests in common. And as this emerges, and we're at the very early stages of this, but it's real, the German government just announced they're opening a military training facility for Russians in Russia. That was yesterday. So as these things develop, it'll be little piece by little piece, but it's heading in that direction.
And to maintain a strong foothold in that part of the world, we need to concentrate on our relationship with Poland.
Well, for Poland, what's going on is the worst nightmare. Germany and Russia, the historic enemies,
yeah,
are getting together again. In the long run, this has always meant disaster for Poland. Polish national security depends on maintaining a close relationship to the United States. For the United States, if Germany and Russia got together geographically, that is the one combination that really could threaten the United States. I don't think China can, but the Russians could. If they were combined with Germany, Russian natural resources, German technology together would challenge the United States on a global basis. So we have an interest in keeping them separate, and that turns Poland into some very important territory for the United States.
George Friedman is president and CEO of the Austin-based geopolitical intelligence firm Stratfor. His latest book is called The Next Decade, Where We've Been and Where We're Going. George, it's always interesting to talk to you. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.